Welcome back to the Digital Orthopedics Podcast and our audio series from the 9th Annual DocSF Experience. My name is Stefano Bini, and I'm a physician at University of California, San Francisco, and I'm the host of this podcast and the founder and chair of the DocSF conferences. The DocSF Science Panel brings together Dr. Jeff Lotz, Vice Chair for Research at the University of California, San Francisco, Department of Orthopedics, Tom Peterson from the AI Research Team, also at UCSF's Department of Orthopedics, and Dr. Peter Schilling, a researcher from Dartmouth, who's dual trained in sports medicine and arthroplasty, and also had several startups in his background, to discuss the impact and potential of AI in orthopedic surgery. They explore various research papers focusing on the use of AI models such as ChatGPT, say example in medical triage, diagnostic performance, and surgical decision making. And the panelists share their insights on artificial intelligence's current capabilities, limitations like hallucinations, and AI's future prospects in healthcare. The panel also touches on ethical considerations brought on by AI, the regulatory needs that have arisen, and the necessary balance between human expertise and AI assistance. The session concludes with a discussion on the appropriate use of artificial intelligence in medical research and writing. It's a great session. Enjoy DocSF Science.
So very excited for this segment of DocSF Science. We are going to go through some interesting papers that will shed some light on what's happening and what's coming, hopefully. So with me, I have a formidable group of panelists, and I invite them on stage. Jeff from UCSF, one of the most accomplished researchers in the country. Tom is our expert, super expert in AI, now leading the group of AI at UCSF. And Peter from Dartmouth, fantastic. Thank you. So we are going to have a look at the agentification of orthopedic surgery. We discussed a little bit about agents before and what that means. And we are going to look at six papers, two on mass, two on copilots, and then hybrid models. And we'll see everybody start thinking that AI is going to replace all of us and it's going to be the doomsday ahead. Just want to bring back everything in perspective. The human brain uses 100 trillion parameters. AI, the most advanced model right now, is at 100 billion. The power consumption of our brain is about 20 watts. To try to power one of this model, it requires hundreds of megawatts. So the power consumption is really incredible. So our brain is still much better than any generative AI that it's out there. So let's keep this in mind. So we are going to go through the first couple of papers here are talking a little bit about the application of ChatGPT. This particular one, as you can grasp from the title, is triage capabilities and diagnostic performance for patients with knee pain. And so I'm going to ask our panelists now to give us their impression on this paper. You know, Peter, what do you like, what you didn't?
It's a nice proof of concept. It's very, very simple, a nice early foray into this concept. I think framing it as a proof of concept helps to sort of sweep under the rug some of the criticisms. I think my criticism would be that, number one, ground truth would be defined by two surgeons. And I don't know, I'd have to say there's a lot of scenarios where two surgeons don't agree. These were relatively simplistic situations. Number two, the ChatGPT did well, but you know what you really care about, I think, in these situations is the edge cases. So the really out there things where the surgeons might disagree. And so these appear to be relatively simplistic. Moreover, I'll probably just pass it on to the others. I have other ideas about how to evaluate these that I would call sort of a more modern updated Turing test.
Tom, your take?
Yeah, I thought this was a great paper. What's really interesting about this paper is that it starts off with 70% accuracy here and it boosts to 100%. The way they did this was by feeding it more information, giving it more information about the vignettes. So it really goes to show that, you know, if it has access to more information, if you can actually centralize this information in a way that AI tools could read it, theoretically, it could get you a better performance at triaging, like this person has knee pain. Should I talk to a doctor? Probably you should. And I'd be very worried about hallucinations in this particular use case or any of these use cases here. I think that in the future, maybe we'll get to a point where these can help initially triage patients. Say that you go to Kaiser or you talk to your physicians here at UCSF. Maybe it can point you in the right direction one step before, and it'll get you there a little bit quicker.
Jeff?
You know, one of the questions that we wrestle with is what information is needed in terms of improving these kinds of decisions, imaging, if it's imaging, what kind of imaging? Is it the raw imaging? Is it the reports? Are there features extracted from imaging? So it might be blood tests. There could be other data sets. So, you know, we're trying to, in a different context, come up with some protocols to help figure out, can we, as opposed to looking at everything, which practically is not possible right now from a cost standpoint, which data types add the most value? And I think that's where we'll probably be learning the most soonest, for example, imaging versus blood tests. Those things are relatively available and could be used in these kinds of algorithms.
Thank you. Next paper. Can ChatGPT make surgical decision with confidence similar to experience knee surgeons? And they.
And about whether or not you could recommend a unicompartmental knee replacement as opposed to a total. Again, early foray, it's kind of a basic process, but I think the premise is a little bit off because the way they frame it is, can you recommend to the patient a unicompartmental knee? And at least I know in my practice, that's not how I frame it, that it's much more of a discussion with the patient, shared decision-making, and it's not a procedure I would convince anyone that they need, that that's something that if they're interested in, you kind of let it evolve more naturally within the conversation. So I'd have to say I was not thrilled with this paper, that some of the basic foundational things I would approach differently.
Tom?
Yeah, I thought a really interesting point that was made in this paper is that sometimes the surgeons didn't agree as well. And, you know, when you have ChatGPT now in the mix, you know, you have expert surgeons, you have ChatGPT. And in the end, how much confidence should you put in either of these groups? And, you know, one of the points that they're making here is that ChatGPT was actually more confident in its decisions than the surgeons, right? So in the end, you really need a human in the loop here, no matter what, at its current state. Will we get to a point where we don't need a human in the loop? I'm not seeing it in the near future.
Could you comment on that confidence part?
Because so it wasn't incredibly clear how they got it to rate its confidence. I've also tried to get these large language models to rate their confidence, and sometimes it ends up being kind of hand-wavy how they got there. It's not clear how it comes to that decision. Oftentimes, it's just very confident in general, which is why I think there's probably a high mean confidence here.
Jeff?
My impression maybe is related to your comment about what I see as one of the big challenges of this area is training, and that you have data scientists who aren't familiar with the clinical situation. And this, I view, is analogous to aerospace engineering and medicine 30, 40 years ago, where there's a lot of great powerful tools for modeling implants and looking at stress and strain, and clinicians didn't know what that meant. The engineers didn't know what the clinical question was. They could show you stress on an implant, but it may be irrelevant. So I think we need data scientists to really get embedded with clinicians to learn the language and the culture to bring, I think, a tighter alignment into the analyses relative to the, you know, the pressing unmet needs that clinicians have. The language is different, the cultures are different, and I think that can be addressed, hopefully, with better education training programs, maybe like a medical AI degree or something like that.
Okay. This paper, clinical agent, it's a new mass model and a clinical trial multi-agent system with large language model-based reasoning. What do you take?
Yeah, I mean, from the technical perspectives, I'm not going to be your guy, but I like the concept. I mean, it's basically like saying, hey, let's get a bunch of doctors together and try to decide, hey, is this a good idea? Is this going to work? Should we sink tons of money into a clinical trial? Which is the thing I think about is like, wow, how expensive is a clinical trial? It's so narrow, so expensive. You better be right that it's a good thing to check. But I don't know. What do the experts think?
I think that people here at UCSF have put a lot of thought into these types of tools. Specifically, it goes into drug bank and safety precautions. Like you said, clinical trials are incredibly expensive. If there's some way that you can guess whether or not it's going to work, that's incredibly valuable. And really the problem is, I think it could also hinder some clinical trials that might actually work, right? So what if this thing comes back and says, because of the safety profile of this drug, maybe you shouldn't run this clinical trial where, you know, maybe it was hallucinating, maybe it was wrong. You know, there's a lot of promise to these tools, but again, you know, the accuracy and verifying whether or not this entire system is working as it should be is currently unsolved problem.
We're interested in this just because of the potential and cost saving. And so it may, I hopefully encourage people to have clinical trial data available to train. It could be a control group in a clinical trial that's already been done. Could be a control group for a trial you want to plan that requires people to share data. And if you've got a proprietary something that you're studying, you don't necessarily want to share data. And there's a lot of unpublished clinical trial data of failed technologies that I think would be really beneficial for this purpose. And so perhaps some governmental push to get people to share clinical trial data could be really valuable here.
Are we using all the clinical trial data that might be available as well from prior studies where they're asking a narrow question, but maybe there's else? Some of the things to be learned from?
No, I mean, we had an effort to try to bring together as much as we could. It's not simple. And there's a lot of harmonization has to happen and data use agreements. And so,
the second in this bucket, case manager, another MAS. So an agent controlling the activation knowledge sources of an FHIR-based distributed reasoning environment. It's a mouthful.
Yeah, I mean, I think the short of it here is, I mean, this is for management of cancer patients. And of course, there's different dimensions and aspects to a cancer patient. You know, there's the actual medical treatment together. To me, it's like this is kind of the idealized state of something that you aim for. From a technical perspective, it seems to me like that's something probably hard to do across a lot of institutions, given how far behind most are in terms of infrastructure. But yeah, what do you guys think?
Yeah, the nice part about this is it's a FHIR system, which means that it interacts with the electronic health record and other sources of data within the institution. And also, if you have things like sensors on the patient, it can interact with that and upload it into your EHR, right? So it really has a wide view of the patient in general outside of the hospital. This could be app-based potentially. Specifically, this is focused on side effects for cancer treatments. So if you get a particular side effect, it knows when this is something that needs to be addressed and things you can do to alleviate those side effects. So outside of the hospital, this is actually pretty cool as far as whether or not it gets it right all the time, as far as, you know, is it capturing all the data for all of your cancer treatment needs? Not necessarily for what I'm seeing yet, but again, maybe in the future, this could be a really good tool.
That's a work in progress.
Yeah, I see the value in terms of coordinating care from multiple providers that a lot of times now the patients are having to do this. There's a time delay and getting access is particularly challenging. So I can see.
So here, the last two papers are on hybrid system, right? So MAS and Copilot together. So this one is a medical education Copilot based on MAS framework.
I read this morning and I immediately sent it to our residency director because I just wanted his input. He hasn't gotten back to me yet. You know, coming from Dartmouth, I mean, we're off in the country, so make a little bit of fun of me for coming to these tech conferences. So I wish we could have got his input. To me, I mean, I think it sounds like where it needs to go in terms of education. Again, well, I don't want to be Debbie Downer, but, you know, the concept of if you build it, they will come. I don't know. It's hard. Students, they're so busy. It's just like, are they going to be engaged with it? I guess you could always force them. Next.
Yeah. So the thing about Medco is that it's a tool to help medical students make decisions and it's supposed to help teach them, right? So it tries several different technologies, including Llama and ChatGPT, and it sort of gives them an output of like what this AI system thinks. And this could be used as a crutch if you don't know what you're doing. In the paper, it shows that it actually made the med students better in certain cases. But how different is it from a medical student reading a book? You know, should they read a book first? There's a lot of questions about, you know, when this is useful and whether or not you can over-rely on it.
I guess my concern is the nature of medical training, I view, is kind of an apprenticeship model. And the time, the technology is evolving faster than evidence can be brought into that model to then justify a change. And I think the same thing is true. I think in robotic surgery, people do a thing certain way because they were taught to do it a certain way. And we train residents a certain way because that's the way they were taught. You need evidence to change. So, and where you generate evidence, the technology is changing. So it's a complicated thing to know when to put energy and investment into these new technologies just because of the dynamic nature.
The last paper, generation and human excerpt evaluation of interesting research idea using knowledge graphs and large language models. So this is close to my heart. And Jeff, I want to start with you on this.
Yeah, we've actually been putting a lot of thought into this from the context of hypothesis testing, and particularly for complex medical conditions where there's literature that's not necessarily accessible. And so to have a well-formed hypothesis in the context of a research or a clinical and staying on top of the literature really is difficult. So I think this approach to me is really going to be powerful to kind of help you quickly get to the place where you can see, is a hypothesis plausible? Are there studies you didn't know about that refute it, support it, that might allow you to pivot a research question early enough before you put a lot of effort into expense, et cetera. So I think to me, this is a really important area.
So will this impact creativity?
Well, I think so. I mean, because I think it'll help you find connections. I mean, I think of creativity in one way where you have an observation and an experiment, and then you start thinking about, well, what implications that might be. We just had an example of this, a study that we're funding to look at a drug for salivary, their hair didn't turn gray. So we think, huh, that might be a neat treatment for gray hair, which the ship has sailed for me, unfortunately. But but I think, you know, the ability to close the loop on an observation and a hypothesis, and is it worth pursuing or not, I think this is going to be really valuable.
Tom?
Yeah, one thing I think is really interesting here is the policy aspect. So in Nature and Science, if you're going to publish a paper, not only do you have to disclose if you had an AI tool write things for you, but if it came up with a significant idea, you have to disclose that as well, right? So a person like me who uses ChatGPT all the time, my ideas are totally intermixed with the computer, generating new research ideas. Absolutely. You know, so how much do you really need to report for something like this where, you know, say you give it a bunch of data and it says, have you thought about this? And then you go test it somewhere else. Was that the original idea? It's not clear to me, right? But I definitely think that this is something that in the future, not even in the future, right now, you can upload not only your preliminary data, but some of your existing research, and it can tell you where to go next.
Peter.
Yeah, I love this paper. It's by far my favorite. To me, just thinking about science, I mean, here with the big time scientists, but that I'm going to come up with a hypothesis on my own based on my world experience and get a slice of experience, but compared to the entire world of knowledge and what might be possible when you start making those connections, to me, it just, this is a really powerful approach. And after reading it, I just got all these ideas. I want to go play with things like this. This is neat.
Perfect. Now we have about 9 minutes left, and I want to have a broader discussions with you guys. Especially on generative AI and some of these tools and how they are going to impact reality right now, but also the future. So, Peter, how generative AI and pets, orthopedic care?
Tough one. I mean, I think it's really just to some extent underappreciated within clinical medicine, how foundational it's going to be. Right now, I kind of started off some months ago or years ago just dabbling with these during clinic or around on my operative days, just to see what it would generate and whether I agreed with it or didn't. And let me tell you, I haven't stopped doing that. And I actually really do learn things from it. So it's a really hard thing to predict. So I think it's just a matter of playing with them and continuing to iterate.
Tom, what keeps you awake at night about this?
Well, I don't think that AI is going to take your job necessarily. I don't think it's going to take my job. I would prefer if the orthopedic surgeon already knew everything it could learn from ChatGPT. But in this world, I'm not sure if that's entirely possible. And we did talk about, you know, having AI tools teach med students, and, you know, that might be more efficient than learning it from a textbook or from a mentor. In the future, I think that we're going to be having these more accessible. So we might even not have to look at our phones to ask the ChatGPT anymore. Right. So these things are definitely coming and they're going to be everywhere in the future. And it's not necessarily they're going to take your jobs, but it's going to make your job easier and it's going to make you more efficient, hopefully.
Jeff.
I think the opportunity is in merging data that crosses preclinical and clinical data. You know, now that there's a push in to have all of your data accessible when you publish a paper. And so if you can mine preclinical studies to look at, there might have been an animal study that was published in some obscure journal that had a signal that you're actually seeing in patient data and being able to link those, I think that's going to be possible. So I think the next jump in, particularly integrating basic and clinical research, will be the availability of the data that can help benefit these kinds of technologies.
Peter, what are your concerns in adopting some of these technologies, especially in the medical healthcare sector?
I mean, some of them have already been addressed, so I don't want to reiterate what's already been discussed in the conference. But I think there's a lot of unknowns, and I should be very curious what you think. For example, something called algorithmic shortcutting. I've seen a lot of papers where they try to base imaging for statistical inference. And what I think well understood is how much information is within these images that we're not seeing, and actually a human may not even be able to conceptualize what it is in terms of patterns of pixels and what that can mean in terms of biases within the model. So that goes beyond sort of just even issues of fairness. It starts touching on whether or not it's truth. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that? And maybe I'm going into the weeds on that one.
Yeah. A lot of these things that the chatbots come up with are not true. I've received some flack because I've told everyone I know to start using them. It's so good. And then as soon as you try and find one reference, it makes it up or it's not real. And they tell me, you know, why'd you tell me to use this? It's wrong so many times. And I say, well, yeah, you have to go and double check it. And they say, why am I using it in the first place? You know, so in the end, maybe I think it's going to get better at hallucinating. I think there's going to be more AI internal regulatory systems to make sure it's getting things right and to know when it's not getting things right. So I think in the future, this is going to get better. Hopefully we won't in 5 years be talking about hallucinations as much.
It's interesting because, you know, using some of these tools, for example, you were mentioning references, right? And I noticed that ChatGPT is not, as you said, very good at references. Most of the time, I would say 90% of the time on point on references. So help me understand how different how all the models that, or the major models that we are dealing with, and how that's going to evolve in the future.
There's a lot of research papers out right now about benchmarking these different tools for different tasks. I would have liked to see more Claude in some of these papers that we went over today, but some of them did have Claude, and sometimes they say it did better in certain circumstances. They're obviously being built off of different data sets, so it will know different things. And the algorithm that Claude is using to actually make those references is probably more of an algorithmic thing and not a data thing, right? Mm-hmm. So there's some kind of magic they're doing under there that gets the references correct. And I also know that Bing's Copilot is a little bit better at that than ChatGPT. Maybe it's because it is more search engine based. But again, I think in the future, some of these problems will be hammered out.
Okay. Jeff, one of the questions I'm struggling with is when we interface with these tools, we have the tendency to ask questions and interface with them as I interface with you. Like if these chatbots were humans, is it a concern? Is something that it will have an impact?
Well, my biggest concern is that we're going to abdicate thinking. And particularly in training, you know, we need to have people have critical thinking skills. And that's not only doing the work, but doing the writing. You know, most of the time, I don't really know what I think until I try to put it on paper in the context of a proposal. And if you're delegating that, I think we're going to have a generation that don't know how to think. An example was in computational modeling. You know, at one point, you really had to be an expert in continuum mechanics to know stress and strain and do all this stuff on a whiteboard. Then the computational models came and had these really pretty pictures. They're really easy to use. And students would begin using these off-the-shelf software tools to generate these pretty pictures, but they didn't know the underlying math. And so there's going to be this potential loss of the depth of knowledge that should come out of training programs and carry into professional careers we're going to lose.
So this has been amazing. First of all, I love how you set up, you use your session on AI to tell us about these models and you showed us the data. So it's really well done. You guys have been amazing. But I just have one question I really want to ask. We're running out of time. And I'm going to take prerogative as the director of the thing. How do we use these models in a context of writing papers? Where do you be allowed use GPT? I'm going to go to a conference. I'm an associate editor of a journal, and I'm going to argue that we should enable people to use these, largely because often I see papers that really somebody should have read them and just corrected the grammar, if nothing else. But it's a huge issue for us in orthopedics. Where do you mind if you, because you showed so many, this basically really asked that question.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of unstoppable. I mean, how are you going to come down and just say, nope, didn't do it? I'm like, really? Sure, come on. So it's how to do it responsibly. And I mean, I think sort of declaring conflicts of interest, I mean, that's kind of what's happening now. But I think there's something to be missed by not doing it as well. And I agree with you. It does inform my thinking in terms of outlining my thinking. And I have used it for writing in terms of a basic outline and adding some structure. It's useful.
I mentioned earlier that you need to acknowledge, use these tools in the acknowledgement section. We're currently working on the best statement that we can possibly make that doesn't say it did everything and that we mostly did it, but we still have to acknowledge that it was there. Really, in the end, it's invaluable for correcting your errors even. You know, sometimes even my students still check, fix these errors and the chatbot got it for me, you know? So in the future, I think that all AI research or all research is going to be partially AI driven, especially in the text.
I guess I'm opposed to it on the conceptual side in terms of it becoming a crutch that really, I think, handicaps us as investigators. But I do think it's important for grammar, language. You know, you get reviewing articles for journals, you get something from a non-English speaking individual, and it's just really painful to read. So you could imagine this could really streamline that process.
Sounds great. Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure. Thank you, guys.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Digital Orthopedics Podcast, and hope you'll make a note to join us for the next Digital Orthopedics Conference San Francisco in October. Take care. Bye.